The edited recording you're about to hear is from a Pivot Spokane main stage event that was captured live on October 26, 2023, at the Washington Cracker Building in downtown Spokane. The theme of the evening was guilty, which can include anything from a troubled conscience to an indulgent pleasure. But the stories are all true, and they're all delivered without the benefit of notes. There were six storytellers in total at this event: Charlene Williams, Matthew Kubik, Nick Franco, Karis Thatcher, Sindhu Sirapaneni, and Carmela Conroy. The interstitial music was provided by DJ Normo. And the MC for the evening was Meg Berlat.
Hi everyone, my name is Meg Berlat. I'm lucky enough to be able to be your Pivot host this evening. And y'all are in for a treat, because tonight's theme is guilty. You get to hear some really incredible stories about the toughest human emotion. Guilt and shame is so hard to feel. And you are about to see six storytellers on this stage who are not only willing to feel it in front of you, but they're willing to talk about some of the worst things that they have ever done, both heartwarming, heartbreaking, and hilarious. One of my favorite quotes about storytelling comes from the author and storyteller Anne Voskamp, and it says that shame dies when stories are told in safe spaces. Right? I know. So thank you for being a safe space for everybody here tonight. Some of you might remember that last April, a lot of you were so gracious and kind enough to come watch me tell a Pivot story about one of the hardest things that has ever happened to me. It feels a lot easier being up here, by the way, without talking about like some of your deep-seated trauma. So I hope that tonight is a little bit easier. But I was so thankful as all of you helped me carry my grief for 10 whole minutes. I told a story about baking and about beavers, but really what it was about losing my mom suddenly a couple of years ago. And it transformed me in ways that I can't quite explain to you in words, but that I felt in my heart and that I have lived every day since. So I wanted to thank the Pivot Board for creating this amazing environment where we all feel safe enough to kill our shame and to tell our stories, right? Yeah. So huge thank you to the Pivot Board. Huge thank you to every single storyteller who is here tonight. Y'all are brave souls. I remember being in that place. I'm in that place a little bit hosting, but it's not quite as bad. But I also get to tell you about some of my guilty confessions. I'm a second grade teacher, and I see guilt all over kids' faces all the time. And tonight, I'm not wearing my guilt on my face. I'm wearing it on my belly. There is a half-baked baby girl in here. Like I said, you guys helped me get through a really difficult time, helped me talk about my trauma and the grief of losing one of my favorite people. And I just want everybody to know there were so many of you that came out and talked to me afterwards, and you told me about losing your favorite person. People messaged me on Facebook and on Instagram, and your words, they carried me, they lifted me. I'm really thankful that mine meant something to you. And I just want to say that there is so much tremendous happiness to be had, even after those really terrible losses and after all of that trauma. I'm really thankful that I get to do this with her in my belly, and she is just living, breathing, kicking, that I feel sometimes proof that that happiness is still to come. One of our first storytellers gets to talk to us about some really interesting, cool things. So I want you guys to give a very warm welcome to Charlene, our very first storyteller.
Hey, everyone. My five-year-old son, Alex, and I were just coming back to the house after spending the morning at kindergarten assessment. And this was a time where, a few days before kindergarten starts, the teachers would meet all the kids one-on-one and put them through these stations. And my son, Alex, could already read at five. And he could jump on one foot, he could count to 100. So I really felt like this assessment was for me to show the teachers how well I was doing as a stay-at-home mom. And he rocked all the stations, except he got hung up on the coin identification. He didn't know the nickel. We were working on the nickel. And so I felt like I was given an imaginary A- on account of the lack of nickel knowledge. We were heading back home, and I could not wait to regale my 1-year-old son, Josh, my 3-year-old son, Matthew, and with the tale of how well Alex did, and also my imaginary A-. And so we opened the door, and I was about ready to tell them of how wonderful it was and how I was killing it as a stay-at-home mom, only to be met by their dad, who told me that Matthew had been playing with a balloon and somehow stepped on it funny, and he was complaining that his knee hurt. Now, my first response, of course, was care and concern for my child who might be injured. But right behind that was, wait a minute, I had really fun things to tell you about my imaginary A- on account of that lack of nickel knowledge. And I wanted to tell you all about how I was killing it as a stay-at-home mom. And then the tertiary response right behind it was, how dare you? We have plans for today. We're going to the beach. And I am nothing if not a woman who follows the plans. And then quickly back to that first response of care and concern about my child who might be injured. So I walked over to the couch where Matthew was whimpering and assessed his leg. He was complaining that his knee hurt. And there was no redness, no swelling, no sign of significant injury. I did call the doctor, and they assured me you can't break your knee, and that he probably sprained it, and it would be painful for a couple days. Well, right at that time, my friend showed up, the beach friend, and she came with her kids, and we were about ready to go to the beach. She was a massage therapist, and so I figured she had taken anatomy and physiology and knew more about balloons and knees than I did. And so she assessed Matthew and said, well, there's no way he broke his femur. That is the biggest bone in the body. And so off we went to the beach. And Matthew was whimpery on the drive there. I assured him it wouldn't take that long. I was concerned he was uncomfortable, but what better way to distract a 3-year-old than the waves and the beautiful views of the ocean? We didn't stay there very long, but we decided afterwards to head to my friend's house. The boy's dad was working long hours at that time, and it just made more sense for us to be out of the house and with other people. And so we headed to her house. And at the beach, you know, I put Matthew into the umbrella stroller, and I four-wheel drove him down through that deep sand to the water's edge. And he was pretty uncomfortable, and then trudged him back through the sand afterwards. We got to my friend's house, and I could feel the impatience kind of welling up, that this had been all day now that he's complaining about his leg. And Matthew, it's probably sprained, and it's probably going to be sore for a couple days, but like, come on, buck up. And then he had an accident on my friend's couch, and I could feel more impatience welling up inside of me, like, Matthew, pull it together. It's going to be painful, but you can't pee on people's couches. We headed home, and their dad and I decided that if Matthew was still uncomfortable in the morning, we would definitely call the doctor. There was still no redness, no swelling, no sign of significant injury. Until 1 a.m., when I awoke to a screaming Matthew and a very red and swollen leg, and I took him to the emergency room in the middle of the night. And as I'm driving to the emergency room, I went right past Lemon Avenue Elementary School, where I had just gotten that imaginary A- on account of the lack of nickel knowledge. And I wondered what the grade would be that I would be given now. I got to the emergency room, and they did some x-rays, and then the doctor came in and told me that they would need to transport him by ambulance to the children's hospital for further testing. And so I drove behind that ambulance all the way to the hospital down Interstate 8, where we had just driven to go to the beach. And I wondered to myself why I needed to be somebody who followed all the plans, and why did I take my son to the beach when he was so uncomfortable? And I could see the nurses taking such great care of Matthew in that ambulance. I could see through the back window. And I even could see them blowing up a glove into a balloon and drawing a smiley face on it to entertain a three-year-old boy. And I wanted to say to them, no more balloons, okay? Like, I'm a sign language interpreter. I've taken so many classes on nonverbal communication, on body language, and I wanted to say to Matthew, I'm sorry, I missed it. And I wondered what the grade the nurses right now would give to me as they were caring so well for my son when I did not. We drove up Interstate 805 to get to the Children's Hospital, and I parked my car and made my way in to the room where they had admitted him because he had a spiral fracture of his femur, a fracture up his leg like a paper towel roll seam. And they all wondered out loud how this happened, because often these injuries are associated with child abuse. And so a lovely woman came in to ask me how it happened and when it happened and what we had done since it happened. And I told her that he was playing with a balloon and he stepped on it funny and it didn't pop. And that it was about 10 o'clock yesterday morning. And then we went to the beach. And they wondered if the injury had been that serious when it originally happened before all the activity of the day. And wondered if his growth plate would be impacted, if he would need surgery, serious things like this. And I wondered what grade I was getting now. They told me that Matthew would need to be in a spica cast, a body cast that would start from just below his chest on the injured leg all the way down to his ankle, and on the non-injured leg just above the knee with a bar connecting them for stability for 6 weeks. And he was three. And Matthew wouldn't be able to stand or sit. He couldn't go in his car seat. They gave me a special vest that I would zip him up into and then lay him down on the back seat of the car and buckle that vest into the seat belts. No umbrella strollers for Matthew for a while, no beaches. And I was on bathroom duty while he sat on the couch in his body cast as a three-year-old who was potty trained but now couldn't get to the bathroom. And so I would bring the necessary receptacle and then dispose of it afterwards. And eventually he army crawled at about 3 weeks, and he was three. And so our new mode of transportation was a red, chunky, plastic radio flyer wagon. And every day when it was time for Alex to go to kindergarten, I would hoist Matthew in his body cast into that wagon, and Josh, age one, into the wagon. And I would pull them with Alex beside me, taking very good care to make sure that they were both okay in the wagon. And we would walk down Madison, left on Bancroft, right on Lemon Avenue, under the freeway, 0.6 miles, to drop Alex off at kindergarten. And then I would turn that wagon around and oh so carefully walk them back down Lemon Avenue, left on Bancroft, right on Madison, to home, until it was time to pick Alex up again, where I would hoist Matthew back into that wagon and Josh back into that wagon and walk them down Madison Avenue, left on Bancroft, right on Lemon, taking such good care that they were okay. And we would pick up Alex, who eventually mastered the nickel. A plus all around.
Our next speaker is so brave because he's willing to talk about this time in his 20s when things were, he had a lot of ego and he thought he was just the best and he was making the best life choices when really he wasn't. One of my favorite things about tonight is that not only does it have a lot of guilty stories, but it talks about, all of these speakers talk about what happens after the guilt, what happens after that terrible human shame that we all feel, and what that is. Is forgiveness
and redemption. Matthew, please come join us.
Honolulu, Hawaii, 2013. I was out gallivanting with my girlfriend and two of my best friends. I was doing all the bad things that a 21-year-old does. Violence, drug abuse, chasing tail, all of that stuff. I remember distinctly that night, my buddy Jesse was looking at a police officer car about 10 yards away, police officer in the seat, and he sprinted at the car full pace, proverbially sticking that middle finger up to the police officer. This was a common night for me during the time. A previous night, about a night before, I was out with my buddies and we got in a gang fight. Brand new Toyota Tacoma comes up, bunch of locals jumping out of the back of the car with baseball bats and knives, start wailing on us. Driver gets knocked out, has a seizure on the floor. Another gang from another side is throwing glass bottles at us. Some guy pulls a knife on my brother. Crazy night. So back to the Ala Moana Beach night. I was out with both my friends, my girlfriend that I loved dearly. She was so beautiful. I remember in class is where I met her. She turned around, looked at me, and she asked me to be in her group. And I just remember looking at her, she had long dreadlocks all the way down to the middle of her back. She had like this gymnast build, and she had these eyes that looked like the gemstone tiger's eye, if you know that gemstone. And so I was out with them, I was feeling extra cocky, and I look at my brother-in-law, and I'm thinking, I want to tell him what I believe in. So I'm like, hey, Mikey, I want to tell you what I believe in. So he's looking at me, he nods, and I'm like, I believe that I am God. I believe that I can create my reality, is what I told him. And I remember the look on his face started to change. His eyebrows started to arc. I could see the anger in his face. And he belted out, there is a God. And I was like, whoa. I've been yelled at a lot in my life, but this particular time it woke me up. Felt like I jumped in a cold bath. Felt like I got hit by lightning. That night I went home questioning my beliefs. So during this time, I was forming a group. It was called OGAK. It was like an art movement. We had a big old group of people. It was starting to grow 30, 40, 50 people, going to 100. We each had an animal name. And they decided that we were going to be moving to LA to grow the group because it was getting bigger, and that was a better place to get found out. So my heart was broken. Hawaii was where my heart was at. And also my beautiful girlfriend was there, and so we were going to have to depart. So I spent my last night with her there. We laid in her SUV looking up at the stars. We said our goodbyes, and then I hopped on that 747 home. On that plane flight to Los Angeles, I was looking out at the clouds, and I started to think about my choices. I was making a lot of bad choices, and I wondered, is there a God? Does God exist? Looking at those clouds, it definitely looked like something was creating all this beauty. I started to think about the drug abuse, the violence, the sleeping around. And in particular, I reflected on the fact that those months that I was with my girlfriend, I slept with another woman, and I didn't tell her. So I landed in Los Angeles. We moved into this big old apartment. I got the biggest room, naturally. I moved all my stuff into this big room, and I just remember I sat in this giant room, put my stuff down, and I just sat in the middle of this empty room. It was kind of ironic, a little metaphorical. I was sitting down in a massive empty room. As I sat there, I began to pray. I was like, God, if you do exist, please show me a sign that you exist. And on top of that, please forgive me for all of my sins. In that moment, I heard an audible voice, whether it was in my mind or somewhere else, saying, I do exist. And on top of that, you don't need to confess your sins to me. You need to confess your sins to your future wife. And at that moment, it hit me. I realized I was a horrible sinner. I made a lot of mistakes. And I knew that my mission now was to confess my sins to my girlfriend. I didn't know how to, though. My heart was racing in that moment. I could feel the adrenaline pumping through my veins. I called my girlfriend. We had our back and forth talks. I couldn't let the words out, though. I thought about what would happen to her if I told her the truth. I knew it would break her. I could see those tiger's eyes looking at me with the love. She had this look for me that I could tell she actually loved me. Not just was infatuated with me, like couples are when they have the hormones, but she actually loved me. She loved the music I produced. She loved my athleticism. She loved my personality, and I could see it in those tiger's eyes. So I couldn't tell her. Now, during this time, me and my girlfriend, we decided that we were going to be going, she was gonna fly down to Los Angeles, and we were gonna do a road trip up to visit my family, visit her family. So we had this planned out. So she lands in LAX, I go pick her up, I bring her back to the apartment. As we're walking, I'm carrying her bags up this staircase, and I thought to myself, okay, this is it. I need to just jump in like I'm jumping off a cliff back in Hawaii into a big pool of water. Just go for it. Just tell her what happened. I open my mouth. Nothing comes out. More small talk. It was really awkward. We got together. We hugged. We kissed. But there was this weird, awkward thing because I knew I needed to tell her, but I didn't know how to tell her. So there's this awkward energy the whole time we were together. We got our rental car. We started driving up north. First, we're visiting my family in San Francisco. It's my 22nd birthday, so this is August 15th, 2022. We get there. We celebrate my birthday. My parents say that we can't stay there because they don't want me sleeping with my girlfriend in the house. So we keep driving north. We get to a park in San Francisco, and we decide we're just going to sleep here in this park. So we go to the park, we go to the top floor of this playground, we set up, we get all cozy. It's extremely cold, even though we're on the coast in California, and we're looking up at the stars. My adrenaline starts running again. My heart's pacing because I knew I needed to tell her. Voices in the back of my head were telling me, oh, it's your birthday, just take it easy, enjoy yourself, tell her tomorrow. Push it off to the next day. But my adrenaline was running, and I had another voice, quiet voice, just saying, talk to her, just say something. So I opened my mouth. I had no idea what to say. I just said, babe, I need to talk to you about something. She looked at me. I looked in those eyes. I could tell there was an element of shock in her face. And so I opened my mouth. I said, babe, when we were back in Hawaii, I slept with somebody else. She started shaking a little bit. I could see in her eyes that love and affection was gone. She looked through me like I was not there. It was almost like there was this black hole in her eye. She started crying. I hugged her. I tried to kiss her. I told her I'm sorry. We didn't talk at all that night. We didn't sleep that night. It was just her crying and me laying there wondering, what did I just do? The next morning we get up, there's no talking. She's not crying, but she's not looking at me either. So we get in the car and we start driving north. There's no talking. I'm wondering what's gonna happen when we get to her parents' house. Is she just gonna tell them what I said and they're all gonna violently assault me and kick me out? Is she going to break up with me? Is she gonna be permanently broken? I feel partially like I made a major mistake, even though another side of me knew I did what was right. Fast forward a year, we're still together. I'm confessing more sins. Fast forward another year, we're still together. I'm confessing more sins. It's like this cycle keeps going. Confessing more mistakes I made, violence, drug abuse, dirty thoughts, whatever it is, on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Is she ever gonna forgive me? Seems like never. We're back in Hawaii, we're finishing our degrees. I took her to a classroom one day. I sit her down in a chair. I said, babe, do you remember this classroom? She's like, of course I remember this classroom. This is the classroom that I met her in. I rented the classroom. I sat her down. I got down on one knee. I presented a ring to her. I said, babe, I love you. I remember the day you looked at me in this classroom and I saw your eyes and you asked me to be in your group. Well, I'm here today asking you if you'll marry me. And I looked into those tiger eyes. She started crying, but this time it wasn't cries of sadness. It was crying of joy. And she said, yes, I will marry you. I knew she had forgiven me. Thank God. Fast forward a few more years, we're living up in Sandpoint, Idaho, and we're getting married. We've got two beautiful kids, and we got a third one on the way. It's coming in 20 days, all boys. She's finally forgiven me, and that's my story. Thank you guys so much.
I'm especially excited. Yeah, thank you. I'm especially excited for this next story because, like I said, I could just listen to this friend talk forever. He's about to take us back to one of all of our guiltiest times, eighth grade. Nick, please come up and join us.
So in eighth grade, I got suspended because I accidentally helped people cheat on a test. I was actually trying to get them to fail the test. So this happened in the third quarter of eighth grade in the year 1999. And I will always remember 1999 because it was when the universe gifted us with the banger, the timeless masterpiece, Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears. And I bring that up for two reasons. One, I just want you to know that piece of information. Free Britney, glad that worked out. And I remember that song distinctly because I was so secretly obsessed with that song. And when I look back on that time and that song, I remember just how gay I was. And I mean, I'm still really gay now, but I was really gay then. And being gay in eighth grade, entering puberty is kind of challenging, even in 2023. It's especially challenging at a private Catholic high school or Catholic school, eighth grade. And it's even more challenging when you've been going to the same school for 8 years with the same core group of 30 kids. So needless to say, socially, things were not very fun. And they were so not fun, in fact, that I don't remember almost anything from fourth grade. Because as my mom told me, many years ago now, I would literally go home crying every day in fourth grade from all of the bullying. So it probably should not surprise anyone to hear that by eighth grade, I was totally an outcast, a textbook definition of a loner. Now, thankfully, I really loved learning because there was nothing the heck else I was doing. And I was really good at these things called book tests. And book tests are these, you take a test on a book, you're welcome. So you would go to, you would pick out a book from the library, you would sign up to, you would read it, You would take the test on it. It's a 10-question, multiple-choice test. And if you got seven of those questions correct, you passed that test. You needed to pass four every quarter in order to get an A. And so essentially, you needed to do 16 for the year. And the most interesting thing about book tests, I know very riveting stuff book tests are, is that you could read ahead of time. So you were not restricted to only passing four and a quarter. So by the third quarter of eighth grade, I already had 15 done. Remember, I wasn't doing much else. And there was one day in that winter, I overheard two students talking about how they were so concerned that they, you know, I don't know how we're gonna get to four because we're really behind and blah, blah, blah. And these were two of like the quote unquote smart kids. And I'm glad Matt brought up hormones, because I don't know what in that moment got triggered. I want to blame like raging teenage hormonal brain, but in that moment I saw an opportunity to exact my eighth grade revenge for all of the bullying for the past 8 years on these two students. Now, I do feel bad. One of them was not actually that mean to me. The other student, though, was the type of student whose parents thought that they were God's gift to humanity. All the teachers loved them, but secretly, they were like one of the meanest people on the playground. This student regularly made it a point to call out any mistake I would make, loudly and publicly. So maybe this was mainly against that student. So I developed this mastermind plot. I thought I was gonna be this super slick person. I was gonna like ruin their lives. They're gonna have this blemish on their like stellar academic record. And so I came up with a plan. I'm gonna convince them to take a book test on a book that I've never read. I'm gonna convince them that I will furnish them with the correct answers. And then they will find out that they were not gonna pass it. And then they were going to struggle, and then they were going to have this horrible life. At least for that period of time. And so I decided that I needed to, if I'm going to do this though, I need to like really commit. So I went to the library, and I don't know if it was like on display or something, but the book that I chose for me was like, I'm like, this is the perfect book. For me, this book represented like peak masculinity boyhood that I wanted to give a big, big middle finger to. That title of the book was Old Yeller. So I check out this book. I didn't read it. I read the back cover, I think. I still haven't read it. I don't plan to ever read it. I sign up for the test, take the test, give the answers to the two students, and then I just sit back and wait. Book tests are announced, the results, every week. And because of the timing, I knew I was gonna be in the batch for that week, but the other two students who had taken it were gonna be in the batch the following week. And so your name only gets read, though, if you pass the test. And so I was looking forward to having my name not read aloud, and I could not wait to look at those two students' faces and see their disappointment and shock and like, oh, I don't know what happened. I thought I would pass it. I don't know. I'm so sorry. Well, Ms. Petrig is reading out the names of the students who passed, and who was the last name read that day? Nicholas Franco, Old Yeller, 7 out of 10. Now, looking back, I'm like, why would I copy, and I gave the two students my answers that I wrote on that test. And I'm like, why wouldn't I have just made up, they're all multiple choice, A through D, I could have just given them literally any random set of answers, but I copied the ones that I submitted and gave to Sister James L. But I'm like, but it's okay, it's gonna be okay. I only gave them to two students, and we're three of the smart kids, so no one's gonna suspect anything, and they definitely did not give those answers to anyone else, so everything is gonna work out and it's gonna be fine. And if I could do a Morgan Freeman impression, I would use it to say everything would not be fine. So it wasn't just the three of us who took Old Yeller for the Old Yeller's book test. There were six of us who had taken it by that time. And it wasn't just six of us who had signed up and took it. There were 10 other students who had signed up to take the test. And you know there was only one copy of that damn book in that library. And so Sister James L., I'm sure, was like, well, this looks a little suspicious. So we get called, the six students who took the test, we all get called to the principal's office, but I'm like, and I'm, of course, like, shaking and trembling, but I'm like, wait. No, I just have to tell them the truth. The truth will set me free. I just have to tell them. I was not trying to help them cheat. I was trying to help them fail. And so, like, I shouldn't be in as big a trouble as they are. And that's exactly what I did. My eighth grade teacher, Ms. Petring, and our principal, I was in the office. I said exactly what I told you all, probably a little less, probably a little bit more shaky in voice. And, you know, they didn't believe me. And, I mean, to be fair, I wouldn't believe me either, because it's a ridiculous story that sounds made up. So we all get dismissed for the rest of the day, and then we are suspended for one day, and that was the following day. And I was definitely Kim K. ugly crying for most of those 36 hours. And if you were here for my story last year, you will. I regularly Kim K. ugly cry. It's like a thing in my life. And I did feel really bad. I felt really bad for my parents because, again, we had gone to school with the same 30 families for 8 years. And so there was some damage that I had done to the Franco family name. Sorry again to my parents for bringing it up 15 or however many years later. I didn't realize how much personal integrity and credibility I had built up over 8 years until I no longer had it. And I did feel really bad for getting five other people suspended. But I guess if I look back, I kind of achieved my goal. Maybe more than I wanted to, but I mean, I guess when I do something, I do it really well. I don't know. But I do want to say that for the record, three of us eventually became doctors. So I think we survived, and I think we are all fine. And I did feel really bad. The last person I felt really bad for was Ms. Petring, who had been looking out for me that whole year. I really looked up to her. And what I found out years later is that she was looking out for me almost the entire time that I was at that school. And that was like my, okay, bye. Here's my, you know, big, like, see you later. And then I want to fast forward you, though, before I go to the end of the year. So a couple months later, there are these things called book test awards, and they are these like huge deals, and like the principal comes into the class and she has these like certificate holders, and there's like embossed glossy paper with like, you completed the book test award early before a certain date, and like blah, 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 and this whole big thing. And so it was book test award day, and I will never forget the look on my principal's face when she opened up the certificate holder in front of her and read out the name Nicholas Franco. After all of my criminal masterminding, after literally being suspended related to book tests, who got a book test award? This gay criminal mastermind.
Our next story takes us back to a 1970s microwave? And I just don't really know what other way to introduce this one. So Sharis, will you please come and join us and tell us all about that magical microwave?
When I was eight, I had a babysitter that I don't remember that much about, except that my siblings and I were not very nice to her. Under her watch, I recall my sister knocking my brother's tooth out, excrement smeared on a wall, not even the bathroom wall, steak knife size holes in the screen door, and the wooden dowel for the sliding glass door used as a weapon. Eileen Lauritsen, wherever you are, I am really, really sorry. We made her work for her $3 an hour. But just before she would leave each time, she'd turn a timer on the microwave. And if before it went off, my siblings and I did all our chores and cleaned up our messes and then froze like mannequins on our beds, then she would reward us with bubble yum bubble gum, preferably grape. I suspect the mannequin freezing was inspired by a movie that came out around the same time about a lonely store clerk who fell in love with the pretty mannequin who would sometimes turn into a human after store hours. I don't think it won any Oscars. But there was a time, at least one time, that I was slow to vacuum the shag carpet or to sweep the cracked in some places linoleum kitchen floor, or to take my toys and whatever else was on the floor of my bedroom and shove it up and into the hole in the box spring of my bed. Because if it looks clean, it is clean. I was also unsuccessful at convincing my 9-year-old sister or my 4-year-old brother to do those things for me. Losers. Now, because I hated not winning, and because candy and gum is the currency of happiness at that age, I did what any other reasonable, self-advocating child in my position would have done. The actual work, wrong. I put another minute on that timer of the microwave. Maybe you know the kind. Faux wood exterior, rectangular handle, an unlikely but inspiring list of cooking choices, like braise and saute, simmer. And after some more dawdling, and now impressed with my newly discovered superpower of stopping time, I added another minute. And then another minute. And then I don't know how many total minutes I added to that timer. I also didn't know I was actually adding cook time. Not timer time. The buttons are different, but in the heat of battle for grape bubblegum, some details had been overlooked. I was actually cooking nothing in the microwave for who knows how long. Actually, you know who? Maybe the sitter? This was not a big place. I was not especially stealthy. The infractions were multiple. I believe she was at least complicit with my behavior, which would turn out to be too much to ask of this 1980s technology. Because what I do know is when my parents returned home, the timer having never gone off, the microwave sparked, smoked, and then had a very contained explosion. May it rest in peace. And after the smoke detectors stopped screaming and the burnt smell waned, in police lineup fashion, we were then interrogated about our whereabouts and alibis, and now overcome with, number one, regret, but also fear of punishment, of what if I have to pay for this, and shame, and wanting to make it right, and to be worthy of my parents' trust. I made the game time decision and said I had no idea what had happened. The this was not entirely untrue. I did not know the physics of what would make a microwave do such a thing. But for almost 30 years, I would go on to harbor the unsettled guilt of the murder of that machine and subsequent lying about it. And not until the mature age of almost 40, with children of my own and fading memories on my side, would I even really consider coming clean to my parents that, in fact, I'd played a role in that appliance demise. So, at a picturesque family reunion on Lake Pend'Oreille, with the sun setting and the weather's perfect and we're all really well fed and I have some family allies buffering the outdoor space, my parents may have even been holding my 11-month-old baby twin girls, because who can be angry holding cute babies that are also your progeny? Pro tip. I broached the subject. Mom, Dad, do you remember the microwave we had in San Antonio? The one that didn't make it? Be cool. Deep breath. The thing is, you're gonna think this is funny. You see, I put too many minutes on the timer. Actually, it wasn't a timer. I was cooking nothing for a very long time, and the gum and the explosion, and it was me. I broke it. It's fascinating how 20 people and a couple dogs can suddenly be very quiet. And my mother said, yeah, she knew. As a previous 8-year-old keeper of all truth, self-described pretty good liar, this was a reality I had not considered. And to this day, it is unclear to me why for 3 decades, she never brought it up. Maybe she thought I felt bad enough about it. Or maybe she didn't care that much, which I doubt. She cared about a lot of things. Or maybe she was just happy to get a new microwave. And my father said he didn't even really remember it happened. And then there's Eileen, who I don't believe returned to babysit after that fateful day. I don't know if my parents fired her or if she fired us. I wonder if she remembers it. Either way, I do. And I think I owe her some gum.
Tick, 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 tick.
Our next speaker is the youngest person I've seen at Pivot, which I think is so commendable in the first place. And she is an absolutely astonishing human being, not only because of her accomplishments, which are many, but because of the beautiful way that she talks about them. Sindhu, you have a wonderful way of making things that are not very relatable, because not many of us have accomplished what you have at your age, making them so relatable and making us all feel them with you. So please, everybody, give a very warm welcome for Sindhu.
It was a cold fall day, just like it was today. I was almost 2 years old. I was wearing my favorite purple dress, walking down the stairs, doing my little princess walk. We were going to a birthday party, and we were running late. So my dad puts on my shoes and rushes me to the car and puts on my seatbelt. This 2-year-old princess was not happy. She took off her seatbelt, strutted back inside the house, took those shoes off, sat there for 5 seconds. Then she put those shoes back on by herself, went back to the car and put her own seatbelt on by herself. This is the first time my parents realized what a strong-willed, independent child they were gonna raise. My parents are first-generation immigrants from India. Life here is completely different from the one that they grew up in. In India, school was everything. Kids either became engineers or doctors. So when my parents saw that I was learning quickly and was more mature for my age, they thought it'd be a good idea to put me in a private all-girls school for kindergarten when I was 4 years old. Well, most 4-year-olds were in preschool at this time. This school was very strict. There were tons of rules to follow. You had to wear uniforms. You were expected to read and write in cursive in kindergarten. And my least favorite part was that there was no playground. At recess, the most you could do was play with sticks and stones in the woods next to the school. But one day at recess, I was playing with a few other girls, and some older girls came up to us and took the girls I was playing with away from me because of my skin color. I didn't even know what to think. I was 4 years old. But regardless, I knew that it hurt. And so I was told not to lie in school at a young age, so I never did. One day, the teacher asked all the students in the class what you felt about school. Every kid said, "I love school." I was the only one that said, "I hate school," because of the negative experiences that I went through like that. The school didn't like my response. I didn't like the school, so I left. Fast forward 2 years, I am now in first grade as 6 years old, like any other 6-year-old would be in the public school system. Things are going great. I was making lots of new friends, and I was enjoying my time not having to wear those uniforms anymore. I was wearing all sorts of outfits with so much style. But my most favorite part was that there was a playground. There was monkey bars, swings, slides, everything, you name it. It was all there. One day I was playing at recess on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and a few girls came up to me and told me to tie and clean their shoes because that's what colored people do. Looking around, I knew that I looked different, but I didn't think people would really treat others this way. So I told my parents, and they told the counselor. And the counselor's initial statement was that I was making things up and dreaming of things. I guess it was easier for him to just think that the problem wasn't there. But it was there, and it hurt me. Later, in elementary school, things were improving. 4th and 5th grade, I had great teachers. And finally, at 11 years old, I was finally starting to enjoy school, only for it to abruptly shut down during the pandemic. I don't know about you, but that was a little bit too much time to spend with my family 24/7, locked inside the house. But I wanted to do something good with my time. So rather than wasting my time, I decided to spend my time doing art. Doing art also helped me feel less alone. But I loved doing it, and I would stay up past midnight trying to perfect those portraits to make the details as symmetrical and as perfect as possible. Everything I do in life, for some reason, has to be perfect. And I don't know why, but sometimes my standards are so high, I don't even meet my own expectations. I beat myself up over it. My need to be perfect has come somewhere from not fitting in and a desire to do so. I didn't want the negative experiences in my life to define who I was, so I tried extra hard to be something and do something better than that. So, I thought to myself, why not teach all the other kids in the world who are also bored right now art? Everyone's going through the same thing. So I started doing YouTube videos and uploaded them. Things are going great. But I wanted to increase the audience interaction. So I started doing Facebook Live sessions. And I started off with about 11 followers. And months later, I had over 3,000 followers who were learning art from me and appreciating my time. But I remember one of the first portraits that I taught. It was a girl wearing a winter cap. And I remember, because an adult artist came into the comments section while I was teaching this live session, claiming that my sketch was too dark, and I should learn what I'm doing before I teach it to others. I was confused, because I already told all the students to draw lighter, and I'm drawing darker due to the streaming quality so that they could see it better for their benefit. But all the students came to my defense in the comments, as they were also confused why a grown woman was coming down on an 11-year-old girl teaching free art classes. Later, bigger organizations like TANA, a 100-year-old organization, approached me to do art sessions for their groups too. And I was moderating the sessions, I was answering the questions in the chat, and I was teaching the sessions at the same time. One time, I was teaching a session, and I remember a girl commenting in the chat saying that I'm not even good at art, she can do better than me, and that I suck. I just ignored it at that point. But she thought she was smart by changing her name in the Zoom chat to impersonate someone else, but she wasn't. I still found out who she was. And I reported to the organization, and they offered me a moderator. But if I've been independent my whole entire life, why in the world would I change now? Later, school started opening back up to in person, and things were going good. I was making new friends, enjoying school, going to school and coming back from school on the bus. There are a lot of kids in our community, so where there should be two to a seat on the bus, there is three to a seat most of the times. One day, one of my friends told me to sit next to her on the bus, and I agreed. But I was one of the last few to get on the bus that day, and there was already another girl sitting next to her. And most of the other seats already had three to a seat, so I just sat down next to them. And the other girl that I was sitting next to, not my friend, she pushed me out of my seat and pulled my hair simply just because I was sitting next to her. And that was it for me. I was done. This girl had done things like this since second grade, and this was now sixth grade, but none of which were physical, and this was the turning point for me. The second I got home, I opened that laptop and started writing an email. I told her that whatever she was doing was not okay, and I wasn't gonna tolerate her behavior anymore, and that if she wants to continue doing it, she'll be hearing from the counselor. And this was the first time that I actually stood up for myself. I'm so glad that I did, because a few days later, she gave me a gift, an apology, and a hug, and we've been fine ever since then. It's the way the situation that was handled that changed it. And I've been challenging myself to do different things in my life. Like, I've taught over 400 art classes since the pandemic. I've taught and performed free Bollywood dance throughout the community. I've taught at several elementary schools for the schools that don't have art programs due to lack of funding. I've made through my artwork and donated $20,000 to organizations that support the homeless and low-income families. I've given two TEDx talks at the age of 13 and 14. And I received the Volunteer Service Award from the President of the United States of America for volunteering over 800 hours in the last 2 years alone. But despite all this, there's still a void in my life. And I'm guilty of accidentally portraying a perfect life when I still go through all the struggles that other teenagers do. Some days, I don't feel like getting out of bed. I don't want to go to school, and I worry about being left out. And you might be sensing a common theme here. Throughout all my stories, whether it's when I was 2 years old, when I independently put my shoes on, when I was 4 years old, and I spoke my truth, when I was 6 years old and I told someone about the racism I was dealing with, when I was 11 years old, I decided to do something good with my time rather than wasting it, or when I was 13 and I finally stood up for myself, the common theme here is that I was different. And what I learned throughout my journey at 14 years old now is that I might be different, and that's okay. So why fit in when you were born to stand out?
We learned alongside Sindhu, we solved a microwave murder. with Sharice. And now our final storyteller of the evening, I can't believe that we're already here, Carmela, is going to complete this beautiful journey, and she's going to take us overseas to a land far, far away.
Is this a good, okay, yeah, that works well. Okay, it was fall 2009. It was the first year of the Obama presidency. And Secretary Hillary Clinton was coming to Lahore, and we were really excited. We were the US consulate in Lahore, and a consulate's like a branch office of an embassy. So the embassy was in Islamabad, the capital city. Consulate was in Lahore, Pakistan's second biggest city, and I'd arrived about 6 weeks earlier, and I was like the branch office manager. I was in charge of Consulate Lahore. And Lahore, Consulate Lahore was about 200 employees, Americans and Pakistanis, and we did things like report on political and economic developments in a province which, if it was its own country, would be the 11th largest economy in the world. We reported on the cultural developments and had education exchanges with people in the city that had more universities than the rest of Pakistan combined. We had lots and lots of fabric designers and fashion designers and movie openings and American fast food franchises, and it was such a fun place to be. And we also had some security issues. There had been more complex, multi-casualty terrorist attacks in Lahore than Islamabad and Karachi combined in 2009. And so there were 400 contract security guards and seconded Punjab police officers to protect the 200 of us who were there to enjoy the good parts of being in Lahore. And the visit of somebody as famous and popular as Secretary Clinton meant that we were going to be able to ramp up all the work that we did to develop the bilateral relationship, but it also meant that those security issues were going to be ramped up because it was hard to imagine a higher value target. So when the embassy asked us to put forward some ideas for what the secretary could do while she was in Lahore for about 6 hours, we sent out like 3 days worth of stuff. There were so many things to do. World Heritage Sites, the heads of Pakistan's three major political parties, academics, artists, lots and lots of people. And the embassy came back to us and said, well, that's great, but we need you to add this Sufi shrine. And I hadn't heard about the Sufi shrine. I hadn't been there yet. But I talked to my team, and my security officer said, we don't want to do that shrine. That's on our no-go list. So our security officer pretty much let us go everywhere we wanted to go, and as long as we were careful, but there were about a dozen places on the no-go list because we considered them too dangerous to go to. So we looked at a few more Sufi shrines and sent those up to the embassy as alternatives. And they came back and said, no, this Sufi shrine is the shrine you need to take her to. So the security team went out and checked it out and came back and said, no, we really can't do that. And so I sent a message up to the embassy and say, no, we really can't do that one, but we've got all these other great things. And I got a call from my predecessor, who'd been in Lahore for 3 years and was now at the embassy. And he said, stop fighting this. You need to be a team player, and you need to make this effing visit happen. Only he used the real F-bomb because we were not being recorded for public radio. So, I mean, I'm the new girl. I want to be a team player. And so I tell my security team, I got to go look at the shrine. We got to see if we can figure out how to do this. And I'm not a security expert, but I've been to Afghanistan twice. I did two-year tours there. I had training before each of those tours, and I had training before I came to Lahore. So I had some sense of what we needed to do. I knew that the benefits of this shrine were that it was over 1,000 years old. It was extremely popular, and it represented a very inclusive, loving sort of Islam that was in very strong contrast to the Taliban. And there were groups loosely known as the Pakistani Taliban who were active in Pakistan. So I understood the benefits of a visit to a shrine like that. But we had to weigh that against the risks. And so when we drove up to the shrine, I could see immediately what our concerns were, because there was an 8-lane highway, basically, going right in front of the shrine, and there were trucks and donkey carts and ox carts and the occasional camel and hundreds of motorcycles and cars, and they were right in front of this shrine where anybody could stop and, frankly, attack it. And so that was a problem. And then I look up, and there are buildings overlooking the shrine on three sides, and there are dozens of windows for offices and apartments, and anybody looking down into that shrine would be able to shoot like proverbial fish in the barrel. So this was a problem. We walk into the shrine, and we come, and we can see this staircase that goes down three layers, and there's an underground parking garage that's filled with hulks and dusty vehicles and shiny vehicles, and there's all sorts of traffic in and out of it, which also could be very problematic during a secretarial visit. And to cap it off, if these physical vulnerabilities weren't bad enough, the custodian of the shrine tells us that up until about 3 weeks earlier, they'd had spiritual music called Kavali every Thursday night for 1,000 years. And pilgrims came from all over India and Pakistan to hear this music and to pray together and soak in the spirituality of this fantastic building. But he'd received a letter from the Pakistani Taliban telling him that music was heretical, and they would allow them to continue their charitable works, like the soup kitchen and the prayers, but they had to stop the music. And if they didn't, they would attack the shrine, and they were watching them to make sure they didn't do anything against Allah. We left in a hurry. And I'd never seen my security team so nervous. So we knew there were benefits, but there were also some pretty substantial security risks. And so our third step was to see what we could do to mitigate it. So we go to the Punjab police. And the police are in good terms with us, because we've got about 200 of them who are protecting our facilities and our people, and we've got a great working relationship. And we talk through every other step of the visit of the secretary, and they're fine with the university visit, the business people roundtable, the visit out to the farm of a former prime minister, but this shrine, what could they do to mitigate those risks? Could they close the street, even just a few lanes of it? No, absolutely not. They've closed one gate and one lane of traffic for the Lahore Marathon a few years earlier, and there had been riots so severe that they'd had to use tear gas to calm things down again. And with respect to the issues up above and the issues down below, could they clear any of that out? No, absolutely not. They had neither the authority nor the staffing to be able to clear dozens of offices and hundreds of vehicle hulks from around the shrine. And yes, they had heard that the shrine was being watched by the Pakistani Taliban. And since they had lost about a dozen police officers at a training facility that had been attacked by the Palestinian Pakistan a couple weeks earlier, they had no interest in taking a high value VIP, who would be a high value target, to the shrine under this watch. So we left in a pretty grim mood. And my team, the advance team from the secretary's staff, we had started calling this venerable Sufi shrine the Shrine of Death, because we were convinced that if we'd followed the embassy's instructions, somebody was gonna die. So I went to bed that night trying to figure out what we were going to do to make this happen. I wanted to be a team player. I was new to the job, but this just seemed insurmountable. And I finally went to sleep, but about 3 a.m., I sat up in bed and decided this isn't about being a good girl. This is about doing the job, preserving our relationships with Pakistan, keeping the Secretary of State, and I was not going to carry out the visit to this effing shrine. So I got up and I wrote an email to my bosses at the embassy and set out great detail why it was that we were not going to do this. I forwarded that email to a couple of friends of mine and said, hey, if anything happens in Lahore and I'm not here to talk about it, make sure that people know about this happening. I met with my team leaders the next day and said, okay, we are not going to make this happen. And we started shoving sticks through the spokes of this visit as much every way that we could think of to get the message out to the people up the cultural reporting chain, the political reporting chain, the security reporting chain, that this visit had to stop. And Tuesday night, which was 2 days before the Secretary's arrival on Thursday morning, I got a call from my boss at the embassy. And he said, I understand you're having some difficulty with the shrine. I said, yeah, we're having some difficulty with the shrine. He said, don't worry. I'll talk to the Ministry of Interior and he'll make the police support the visit to the shrine. Jerry, I don't think that's gonna do it. But he's like, it'll be fine. So, and then we had radio silence from the embassy because Wednesday is when the Secretary arrived in Islamabad, and I knew that they would be completely consumed by her visit and everything they were doing with her that day. And so when we went into the Wednesday night countdown meeting, which was the last time we would all be together before we went our separate ways to support the Secretary's arrival the next morning, and the first stop at the Shrine of Death, and it was a very grim mood, because although everything else was going great, everybody on the team knew that this was a problem. And so we took the traditional team photo of everybody waiting for the visit. And then my secretary came running down the hall from my office and said, the DCM's on the phone, you've got to come take this call. And so I go down and it's Jerry with his, who'd been speaking to his buddy, the Minister of Interior, and he said, Carmela, I don't know how to break this news to you. I've just spoken to the Secretary's Chief of Staff and they want to cancel the visit to the shrine in Lahore. And I'm so sorry, because I know you've put so much work into that. And I don't know what to say. But she'll arrive an hour later and the rest of the visit's fine. And I hope you'll be okay with that. And I said, Sherry, I'll figure out a way to explain it to the team. And I went running down the hall and they could tell from the look on my face that that problem had been solved. And Secretary Clinton was coming to Lahore and we were so excited.
Friends, that concludes our guilty night. Long live the storytellers of tonight. Forever may your powerful words reign.
This has been an edited live recording of a Pivot Spokane main stage event that was captured on October 26, 2023 at the Washington Cracker Building in downtown Spokane. The theme of the evening was guilty, and there were six storytellers in total at the event. Charlene Williams, Matthew Kubik, Nick Franco, Karis Thatcher, Sindhu Surapaneni, and Carmela Conroy. The MC for the evening was Meg Berlat, and the interstitial music was provided by DJ Normo. For more details on this and future Pivot events, visit pivotspokane.com.